Hello, everyone. Welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss, a foreign policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. With me, again, is my friend Hussein Ibish, who's a research fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and a widely published author on Middle East affairs. Welcome, Hussein.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be with you again.
So we've seen some very interesting developments in Egypt, to say the very least, over the last couple weeks, especially the last few days over the weekend. SCAF, the military leadership of the country, issued several rulings. There was a court ruling effectively dissolving the parliament. And now we've got the results, or the preliminary results, of the presidential elections in which the...
Well, very disputed, though.
Yes, exactly.
But I agree with you. Only one side is proffering numbers, though.
In which in which you've got both Bush and Gore claiming victory. I mean, Morsi and Shafiq claiming victory. So you've got a very good piece in Now Lebanon Today, which just sets the scene. Can you just sum that up for us?
Some of the Egyptian tweets are wondering what to call it, Bush v. Gore, and I actually like Alien versus Predator best. I think that's a really good one.
Remember the tagline from that was, whoever wins, we lose.
Yes. No, completely. So that it's perfect,
yeah.
I mean, it really is the battle of the kind of the return of the old dictatorship in a new form, old wine in new bottles, and what has every potential to turn into a new, if not dictatorship, certainly a new authoritarian and repressive order. Because obviously, even where you have a situation with voting that is, in that sense, democratic, if you don't have adequate limitations on government protections for minorities, individuals, and women, you can have the emergence of a tyrannous majority. You know, and so that's the other sort of great danger here, as well as the last one, a failed state, which is not what is going to happen in Egypt, but could in other Arab states. So what's happened, basically, is, first of all, you've had a series of elections, you know, first of all for parliament, which was won overwhelmingly by Islamists several months ago, by the Muslim Brothers and the Salafist Nur Party, together having more than 70% in the parliament, the Muslim Brothers with mid-40%, so they're awfully close to majority on their own. And then this presidential election, which had 13 candidates initially that were allowed to run and that were significant in any way, and boiled down to a runoff between two, the former prime minister, the last prime minister of Hosni Mubarak, General Ahmed Shafi, and versus the Muslim Brotherhood's second choice candidate, Mohamed Morsi. And the Islamist forces didn't do nearly as well in the presidential election. That's clear. They say they've won. There's no official announcement. All the numbers that have been proffered by anybody, including the Muslim Brothers and by the media, suggest that Mr. Morsi has won. But we haven't had any official confirmation. The Shafiq camp is now going around saying they've won. So there is some, at least, doubt about exactly what happened and what the election commission is going to announce and rule, and there are a bunch of appeals filed and whatnot. So, but you could well end up with Muslim Brotherhood candidates having done extremely well in both of those elections. But at the same time, you have a parallel process, which has been going on through decrees by the military and rulings by courts, which are also, in effect, remnants of the former regime, especially the Supreme Constitutional Court, but also other administrative courts. And these have included judicial rulings that, as you say, disbanded parliament. They held that the one-third of the parliament, those people who were elected as individuals and not as party list candidates, but who were also party members, were unlawfully, unconstitutionally elected, and they threw out one third of parliament, and on that basis said there needs to be a whole other election. They've dissolved parliament, and also broken up the constituent assembly that is that was formed by parliament, which is tasked with writing a constitution for Egypt, a new permanent constitution. Now, the Muslim Brothers, who dominate that parliament, have said they don't recognize it. They want to try to assemble the parliament, as was done in the 20s. They started meeting in a hotel in the 20s when it disbanded. So this is kind of a throwback. But it doesn't look as if the speaker's call for MPs to show up anyway is being heeded at this point. And the military has said they're going to enforce that court order. So if they assemble, they dissemble somewhere else. And you know, it's a big confrontation. Now, additionally, there have been other decrees where over the past few months, the military, which has been the presidency, which has assumed the role of the presidency since the overthrow of Mubarak, and has now seized the role of the legislature as well, following the disbanding of the parliament by the court. They've accrued legislative powers to themselves as well. They've been issuing a series of rulings that essentially transfer power from the presidency or the legislature to themselves. Mm-hmm. And what they've done, I think it's an exaggeration to say that they've rendered the presidency and the legislature mere figureheads. I don't think that's true. I think they're still going to have considerable authority in certain respects. But what they've done is they've cordoned off key military concerns, like their mm-hmm. budget, like national security issues, the decision to go to war, and essentially reserved those either to the military's discretion or preserved a military veto over those things.
Well, now, let me just interrupt
for
a second, because it seemed to me, like, leading up, before now, it seemed mm-hmm. that the assumption on the part of many people, I don't know if you thought this as well, but it seemed to be, the assumption was that the Muslim Brotherhood was in a sort of, they had a kind of unspoken agreement, or maybe it was spoken, but not official agreement with the military leadership that you've got your yard over there, mm-hmm. and you can control these things, and we're not going to mess with that, and we're going to kind of concentrate on, you know, social issues, you know, to start implementing some of our religious program mm-hmm. in various areas over here in the domestic arena. But what you're describing is that now the SCAF has attempted to make this much
right.
more formal.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in fact, I think the SCAF has gone a little further mm-hmm. Than that. And I don't think that the SCAF and other institutions in Egypt, so this is really a confrontation between emerging political forces and existing institutions that have bureaucracy behind them, that mm-hmm. have a history behind them, that have mm-hmm. Expertise or so-called expertise behind them, versus a kind of political parties with popular dynamics and with machines that can turn out the vote and things like that. Now, I don't know that SCAF and these institutions ever saw it that way. I think you mm-hmm. described very well how the arrangement was evolving from a Muslim Brotherhood perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that's what they thought they were getting into mm-hmm. with the military. But I think that there was maybe a turning point, which is that the Muslim Brothers had said all along that they were not going to run anybody for president.
Mm-hmm.
And when they saw the powers of the legislature being clipped away
right.
by the military decrees and by some court rulings, they did an about-face, mm-hmm. which was no surprise, I think, to many
right.
people who follow them. They're not the most sincere people you've ever met. You know, if they say something, it's that and $3.75 might get you a cup of coffee. It's not worth much.
$3.75, man, coffee.
$2.75, I mean, it's expensive these days, whatever he wants. Anyway, I don't know. I drink coffee at home. Anyway, the point is, it'll get you something anyway, but it won't buy you much, their word.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, so when they did decide to stand for the election, if there was an unwritten, unspoken agreement between the Muslim Brothers and the military, that it was, I think, done at that point.
Yeah.
And so I think also it's worth mentioning some other very important things that have happened recently. The military issued, they bowed to popular will and rescinded the emergency law as the parliament mm-hmm. wanted, and as obviously most Egyptians wanted, mm-hmm. this very old repressive law that
yeah.
is analogous to what's used in most Arab states as a legal instrument of repression. They did away mm-hmm. with that, but then they reissued the authorization
right.
for security forces to arrest people fairly arbitrarily, and more importantly, to refer them to military tribunals.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
due process, civil liberties, protections, etc., thrown out. In,
yeah.
in addition, there was a case that was decided this morning, Tuesday morning, in which the court was going to rule on potentially illegalizing the Muslim Brotherhood again. And that would have been the sort of nuclear option.
Yeah.
And what they've done, but they haven't done either. They haven't illegalized it, and they haven't sort of thrown out the case either. What they've done is they've postponed a ruling until September. So if you want to see the judiciary, and I think it's reasonable to see them, that certainly they speak like that, as, first of all, a coherent, unified actor with rational, identifiable collective interests on the one hand, and also as a directly political group that is perfectly comfortable with intervening in Egyptian politics, then they've left themselves that option. They've left themselves the option of sort of re-illegalizing the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
What effect that would have on a Morsi presidency, I don't think anybody is clear. It technically shouldn't, I suppose, invalidate his presidency, but it would make it very hard for the Muslim Brothers to have this FJP party that they have, and very hard for them to run in elections in the future and whatnot. So there is that. And then there's a whole series of other things that essentially set up what I think is an inevitable confrontation. That is, or a confrontation that's now virtually unavoidable. It's been avoidable until now through understandings or through processes that play themselves out in a, not in a consensus way, but in a way that avoids confrontation, in which one side wins and the other side backs down.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a series of those. I think that's no longer possible. I think you're going to have a political confrontation, possibly also involving some physical fighting of some kind. But I mean, you have now two groups who are vying over similar sets of power, the same sets of authority, the military and its allies and the Muslim Brotherhood and its allies. And the Muslim Brothers, for the first time, have a real weapon to use against the powers that be, against the establishment forces, which is a popular mandate, popular legitimacy.
Right.
Even though clearly their popularity has been decreasing over recent months, nonetheless, they are also still clearly the most important party by far in Egypt. They're capable of producing majorities. They're capable of producing enormous votes. Now, on the other hand, the military and the existing institutions have the guns and they have the institutions. They have most of the state apparatus. And the fact that, let's say that the understood results as reported in most of the Egyptian press at the moment hold on Thursday when we get the announcement, that would mean that Morsi has beaten Shafiq by approximately between 100,000 and 200,000 votes, not 1.2 million as he claims,
mm-hmm.
but by a smallish margin, but a clear victory.
Yeah.
In that case, you'd have to again acknowledge the power of the Muslim Brothers to turn out the vote, but you'd have to note that assuming that Shafiq represents the military and its allies and the old institutions and the kind of law and order, almost, mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it necessarily Mubarak nostalgia, but let's say a certain affection for the existing state and a fear of Islamists, that
right.
has proven to be almost as electorally powerful
yeah.
at this point.
No, I
and
think
so
that's,
you've got a highly divided society. Yeah.
No, I think that's a very important point to just kind of
mm-hmm.
pause on for a moment. I mean, it's not
yeah.
necessarily support for Shafiq as a person or
right.
or the SCAF or for Mubarak. It's just a sense of normalcy.
Right.
A sense of order. We weren't crazy, you know, it's saying, I think it's a very human attitude. We saw a similar thing in Iraq. It was not that we
right.
were crazy about Saddam. It's not that they were crazy about Mubarak. It's just like, we missed yeah. a time where we knew what was going to happen tomorrow. You know, it
right.
was just
no,
a
I
sense of...
No, I think that's right.
I mean, I think you see similar things in states all over the place. I mean, you've seen the, you know, the kind of Stalin nostalgia that took place in,
yeah.
in the former Soviet Union. I mean, there's nothing logical to it beyond just kind of a sense like, okay, we've been completely discombobulated by these recent events,
well,
and we miss a sense of normalcy.
I mean, that's part of that. I think that there is a rational vote for Shafiq, though. It's
yeah.
not just irrational. And that, for example... the Coptic Christians of Egypt are almost
right.
entirely united
mm-hmm.
around Shafiq. Why?
Yeah,
because they are concerned
point.
About, yeah, they're concerned about their future
yeah.
under
yeah.
an Islamist-dominated government, and they're right.
Yeah.
I mean, I would defy anyone to come in with a straight face, tell me that's not a serious concern,
right.
a real concern, and that the Muslim Brothers had done anything serious to assuage those fears.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they have. And I think similarly there are other rational reasons for preferring Shafiq over Morsi.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right about Shafiq votes not being for Shafiq as an individual.
Right.
And he didn't really run as an individual. He ran as a representative of a system
mm-hmm.
And a way of doing things that I think people might be missing because they don't have jobs, they don't have money, they don't have the same law and order that they used to, and all the things you were describing, and some irrational stuff also, as you described it, certainly. But I think also it's important to note, I don't think anyone would vote for Mohamed Morsi based on his personality. It's even less likely than voting for Ahmed Shafiq.
Yeah.
You know, these are two highly uncharismatic individuals, and that's putting it gently.
Yeah.
You know, Mr. Morsi speaks, insofar as he does speak at all, in a kind of shouting monotone, and it's unbearable to listen to him. Actually, the thought of having to, I mean, I really feel sorry for Egyptians, you know, in the case that he actually gets this bully pulpit and they have to listen to him, just on the basis of kind of headache index, it's going to be pretty bad. But I think that, again, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood vote is almost a kind of nostalgia vote as well. Because the Muslim Brotherhood is a very old party, and it hasn't evolved that much. Mm-hmm. And tactically it has, but in terms of its ideology, its rhetoric, its way, its worldview, it's rooted in the late 20s. And, you know, you could say maybe in the mid-50s in a certain sense, but not much beyond that, in the same way that the deep state in Egypt is also rooted in the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And so there is a kind of nostalgia, not for the powers that used to be, but for this very familiar oppositional institution. And it's quite different than people who ran as charismatic individual politicians based on vote for me because here are my policies. People like Abdel Fattah, the so-called liberal Islamist, Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister and Arab League chief, who went to great lengths to try to distance himself from Mubarak, also this neo-Nasserite candidate who did exceptionally well as well. They were all running basically on their individual personalities, and they got pretty well creamed by these front men for, you know, well-established things. So I think it was sort of, all in all, it was kind of a nostalgia freakout and not a very healthy one.
Well, those are all really good points. But I mean, what I'm getting at, I think, in trying to tie this together with, say, Iraq and with the former Soviet Union, is just it's less to do with these individual organizations and people per se than just with what we know versus going forward into an unknown future,
uncharted,
be it democratic
right.
or not. Even though we have the possibility of a more equitable and fair future in which we have better economic opportunity and a better government, but we don't know. And so it's, you know, what I'm getting at is just a very human impulse to be afraid of that and to seek shelter.
There's no doubt. That's definitely one of the factors at work here. There's no question that's one of the factors at work here. I also think, though, if it had been Morsi versus Abdel Fattah, for example, or Morsi versus Amr Moussa, you might have had, especially Morsi versus Abdel Fattah, you might have had a real argument in which fears about the Muslim Brotherhood, their domination of parliament and the presidency, and where they might take the country, from secularists, from liberals, from Christians, from business people who, you know, kind of like the status quo because they made money, not out of any emotional thing, but, you know, just for practical purposes, things like that, or people who are invested in the old state might... You know, in one way or another, emotionally, economically, however it is, that there might have been a clearer-cut version of that, in the sense that you do have the concern about the Muslim Brotherhood. And they didn't run a consensus campaign in the first round. They didn't try to reach out beyond their base. They didn't try to reassure anybody. They played hard right. They, Morsi kind of winked and nodded at female genital mutilation, which is illegal in Egypt. He implied he was going to... it's still widely practiced, but it's illegal. He implied that it was a legitimate choice for any family, a shocking comment, I think, even to Egyptian society, and many other very hard-right comments that a Muslim Brotherhood candidate need not have said, given their ideology. I mean, you could have avoided saying all those things, be perfectly within bounds. Given their party discipline, but he went hard right. And so I do think that there's a sense in which what you're saying is a factor, but fear of Islamists is also a factor in provoking a much higher, much better performance for Shafiq than anyone would possibly have posited, say, 2 months ago. I mean, this is, even if he loses by, say, 200,000 votes, that is in and of itself astonishing. Yeah. And you'd have to both credit the Muslim Brotherhood for weathering a period of unpopularity and still pushing through a majority for an incredibly uncharismatic candidate. And you have to note the extent of Egyptian society that was willing to vote for a fairly unpalatable candidate, partly on the basis that he's not them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's pause on that question for a minute. I had an interesting discussion with Eric Traeger of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy a couple weeks ago, in which he's spent quite a bit of time in Egypt, interviewed a number of Muslim Brotherhood figures, including Morsi. And he very much concurs with your take on Morsi as an unpleasant individual.
Yeah. Just watch him on TV.
But Eric's position, and it's not what I completely agree with, but he's done the work here, so I think it's very much worth considering. His view is just that there is no Islamist road to democracy. It's just they are not interested in genuine democracy. They're interested in implementing Sharia. And my question really is, if we grant that, even granting, I think that there's a good range of views within what we might term Islamism.
A good range of views is a huge view. I mean, everyone from Abdul Fattah to Al-Qaeda is Islamist in a way.
But
it's
not so much can Islamists... I mean, the basic question is, can Islamists participate and contribute to the development of a democratic system?
Well, this is a subset of a much older question, a question that has bedeviled democracies from their outset and representative government from their outset, which is, can a fundamentally liberal system accommodate illiberal parties?
Right.
That's the question, and illiberal parties in power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer, tentative answer that we can derive from history is, yes, if you're very careful. And as you need to have, certainly you can have illiberal parties participating in a liberal system without destroying it.
Right.
As long as you have, ironclad constitutional limitations on government, protections for individuals, minorities, etc., and that the constitution is very hard to change. This was the great failing in Algeria, was they made a constitution that was amendable by supermajority of parliament. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's way too easy. And then they panicked, and the military canceled the elections and put the fairly moderate Islamists into giant prison camps in the Sahara and kicked off this horrible war, which I don't think we're going to see a repetition of in Egypt. I'm pretty confident about that. But that's sort of the nightmare scenario, and it spooked a lot of the Arab world about democracy and about transition to democracy and about Islamists and about military juntas. The whole thing was just a very... and one of the reasons, clearly, that the Arab Spring hasn't spread to Algeria is that there are way too many people still alive who have vivid memories of it. They anything that might militate to going remotely back in that direction is terrifying to them. So, I mean, clearly, anyone who wants to say, and I don't know what Traeger's exact take on this is, but his colleague Robert Satloff wrote several pieces at the beginning of the uprisings, particularly after the overthrow of Mubarak, in which he called for what he termed discriminate democracy.
Yeah.
That was his phrase, in quotes. And basically, as he explained it, I think it was in the Washington Post, it would be democracy for everyone except Islamists.
Right.
Now, that's, first of all, as you know, way too vague, because there's a huge range of people who legitimately fall under the category of Islamists. And secondly, a discriminate democracy, by definition, is not a democracy.
Right.
I mean, really, it's unless you're going through a period of kind of denazification or de-Ba'athification or something like that, in the trying to chip away at the power of the remnants of a dictatorship. That's another story. You can do that briefly, for a short time. But in the end, if it's going to be democratic, you can't sort of say, well, there are neo-Nazis running in Greece, and people are voting for them. Let's ban them. I mean, it's just it doesn't really work that way. If you actually want to have an open system, so rather than trying to exclude people, parties because they're illiberal. And I think, honestly, there are quite a few open-quote liberal close-quotes in Egypt, including some of the courts that are making some of these rulings that are patently, if not undemocratic, at least anti-Islamist and undermine popular franchise and things like that, who are liberals in the sense of their social policies, their attitudes, etc., but they're not necessarily that into democracy. They're not that committed to democracy either. So I think you've got it's not the easiest thing in the world to transition to a democratic system in which illiberal parties are going to be the immediate and primary beneficiaries. But I think that's where the role of a responsible military could actually be played out very well. If the military was doing not what the SCAF is doing and keep taking powers to itself and sort of working with the courts, it would seem. I mean, I don't know that, but it looks that way. To kind of hedge against certain parties and hedge against certain candidates, and instead take the lead in drafting and confirming a constitution that is very clear-cut, very ironclad, very hard to change, and then they would step back and say, all right, you know, now you can do these things, but we defend the constitution. So if you go too far, then you might have to deal with us. If you stay within the bounds of what this thing allows you to do and you actually win the election, let's say, go for it.
People have
the right to make stupid mistakes.
And that's, I guess, the question. I mean, what is the role of the military as we move forward here? I mean, I joked on Twitter last week, you know, after all the talk about, you know, the Turkish model in the Middle East, I joked that, yes, it looks like Egypt's going with the Turkish model, just the older one.
Meaning, a
military, you know, militaries as the kind of having veto power over every aspect of government.
Right.
I mean, that's an oversimplification, but...
joke, though, and I've heard it before also. I mean, there are two Turkish models, you know, so which one?
Right, which one? But I think even though that system in Turkey was, you know, undemocratic, and in some cases, very repressive, there was, I think, a sense in which the military felt itself, or took its task seriously, in sort of moving Turkey down a path of modernization.
Well, you'd have to give them credit for where it's ended up, in the sense that they may not have played their role perfectly, and they may not have ruled well. But if you liked the present system in Turkey, you'd have to give the military some credit for having set it up in a way, willingly or unwittingly. And if you don't like it, you'd have to give them considerable amount of blame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because it seems that, you know, we've had the rise of the AKP over the last 10 years. And it's almost, you know, the Turkish military, yes, you can credit them with creating this system, which has moved past them even as they haven't really noticed it, it seems.
Yeah.
It's completely overtaken them.
They've been unable to stop it, that's
right.
For sure.
So I guess, you know, we have a number of different models here without, you know, just trying to play it simple. I mean, the older Turkish model, the Algerian model, which you're saying that no one wants to use. And then there's Pakistan. What do you think? I mean, and the broader question here is, like, what can the U.S. do? What are our options? And what were the options, say, if we, you know, look using hindsight? We don't want to overestimate the ability of the U.S. to kind of shape outcomes here, but were we too close to SCAF? I mean, should we have pressed harder?
Let me take those two things in two parts. I mean, the first is the Pakistan model, which I'm not sure what people have in mind when they say it, but let's say that the recent history of Pakistan, let's say the last 20, 25 years, has been a kind of revolving door, in which you've had a couple of key politicians and key parties, very rich landowning people from the elite of various different ethnicities, who have managed to, you know, secure parliamentary majorities or coalitions and become civilian governments, repeatedly punctuated by military rule. So you've got this kind of forda of military rule, civilian rule, and neither of them has proven, I think, particularly effective. And so if you were to go by procedure, it's one of the messiest and least sort of reassuring I can think of. And if you want to go by outcomes, it's one of the worst I can think of, because it's hard to imagine a country with Pakistan's sort of size and resources that is as... let me be frank, messed up as Pakistan. It's pretty well of a disaster. And so I think the system couldn't have produced worse results. So for me, I'd prefer almost anything else except the Algeria scenario, frankly. It's really a grim picture. It's not the way a military should behave. No way. The Pakistani military has shown a very strong sense that, you know, as you've seen in some other Asian countries and some African countries, that, you know, if they think things are getting out of hand and people in suits or with beards are behaving badly, they just step in and, you know, restore order, as they would see it, or restore, you know, sanity to government, or however they want to put it. But what it means is ultimately whatever civilian government you have is totally contingent on the military feeling things are tolerable. And if they feel they're not, for whatever reason, they step in. So that is not in any way a healthy way of dealing with things. As for the United States, it's hard to imagine what the United States could have done within the realm of possibility. You know, there are people who are talking about making aid contingent. Well, you know, there's a couple of things about that. First, the aid is tied directly to the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. And one of the great concerns about an Islamist government in Washington is what will happen to the peace treaty. Well, probably nothing, unless you start cutting the aid or making the aid contingent on anything other than the peace treaty. So that's an incredibly stupid idea from the point of view of the American national interest. It might be useful for Egyptians, but it's not in any way a plausible idea from an American point of view, in my opinion. The second thing, it's just silly. It's downright silly. The second sort of thing is the idea that the United States could criticize. I think if you read the statements that have come out over the past few days by the State Department and others, you can see embedded in them, encoded in them, not terribly thickly veiled, fairly thinly veiled, warnings and implicit criticisms directed towards the military. And so should the United States go further? I don't know that that would strengthen our hand, and I don't know that that would, you know, make the military think twice. Events in Egypt really are very local and very dynamic, and I don't think that the United States has a huge role, or Israel has a huge role, or the other Arab states have a huge role. And I think that there's a little, you know, you can do little things. You can also, you know, sort of, one thing the United States could have done, if not the government, certainly civil society, was engage much more with liberal groups and help them organize an alternative to both the military and to the Muslim Brothers. Because the people who brought down the regime were, you know, definitely not driven by the Muslim Brotherhood at first. The Muslim Brotherhood later participated, but then they checked out again. And this is the heart of the idea that they made a separate deal with the military. They stopped supporting the demonstrations, most of them. And they've been very, very selective about which demonstrations they've supported. And I don't think any of the real sort of dedicated revolutionaries who brought down the former regime feel that the Muslim Brotherhood is an integral part of their movement. Clearly they're not. And also the military. So as an alternative to both of those groups, now these forces in Egypt are really totally unorganized. They don't have any effective parties, and they're playing catch-up of at least sort of 60 years with the institutions that exist, 40 to 60 years. And in terms of street-level politics, of 80 years, 90 years with the Muslim Brotherhood, which also has strong regional support, money coming from the Gulf, and particularly Qatar. The Salafists have money coming from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So, you know, there is, I think, a sense in which the outside world, especially the West, might be faulted in having been maybe in a way too agnostic about the outcome. We spent a great deal of money providing democracy training for everybody, including Salafists. And as far as I know, there's been very little discriminate aid targeted at people who share our values in Egypt. I don't know the extent to which that's been offered and rejected. I don't know the extent to which civil society has tried and succeeded, and or rather clearly haven't succeeded. But that's something where I think the United States as a society, if not the government, when these things become legally complex, but and also, you know, problematic potentially for people who take direct U.S. government money for domestic political purposes, legally and politically problematic. But civil society, it seems to me, certainly could have done more and should do more. If we're going to be engaged, we might as well be engaged not only in providing democracy training for everybody, but also in supporting people who share our values. There's nothing wrong with that. That's, I think, completely fine. It should be done, as a matter of fact, on a fairly large scale, I'd say.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this. Thanks so much for talking
today,
Hussein.
Thank you so much,
Matt. I look forward to doing it again. And just a reminder to the viewers, check out our Porn Entanglements Facebook page, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.